coming up on Economics Explored.
Because everyone's talking about digital currency and the central banks of the world are asking themselves, could the central bank issue digital currency? And my answer is they should, and that there are huge gains from doing this. But of course, to do so threatens the existing banking system and their model for making money.
Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. I'm a professional economist based in Brisbane, Australia, and I'm a former Australian Treasury official. This is episode 97, featuring a conversation with Dr. Nicholas Gruen on BS jobs and central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs. Like my previous episode on BS jobs, it contains some explicit language, so please put some headphones on if you have young children nearby. Dr. Nicholas Gruen is a prominent Australian economist that I work with from time to time. He's CEO of Lateral Economics and a visiting professor at King's College London, although he's currently locked down in Melbourne, Australia, which unfortunately in July 2021 is experiencing a COVID outbreak. Nicholas has advised Australian government ministers, he served as a board member on various private and public sector bodies, and he's a noted angel investor. For instance, Nicholas was an investor and the founding chair of data science company Kaggle, which was acquired by Google in 2017. So, obviously, Nicholas is a fantastic guest for Economics Explored, and I'm very grateful to have him on the show again. I invited Nicholas back onto the show because of a great comment he made on my recent BS Jobs episode. In fact, I'd been planning to have him back on the show for a while now to chat about a Financial Times opinion piece that he wrote on central bank digital currencies in May 2021. I asked him about CBDCs toward the end of this current episode. I'll put a link to Nicholas's piece, Central Banks Get Serious on Digital Currencies, in the show notes so you can have a read of it when you get the chance. Regarding the merits of CBDCs, I'll borrow from Investopedia's nice summary of CBDCs, which I'll link to in the show notes. According to Investopedia, CBDC aims to bring in the best of both worlds, the convenience and security of digital form like cryptocurrencies and the regulated, reserved, backed money circulation of the traditional banking system. That sounds like a nice blend. CBDCs are a fascinating development and one I'll cover in more depth in a future episode soon. So please treat the discussion toward the end of this current episode as a first installment and expect more to come. As always, let me thank those listeners who've sent in questions, comments or suggestions. A big shout out to Jeremy, who's just graduated with a bachelor's degree in economics and finance. Jeremy sent in some kind words about the program via our email address, contact@economicsexplored.com. If you have any questions, comments or suggestions relating to this episode or previous episodes, then please email us via that address. Righto. Now for my conversation with Dr. Nicholas Gruen, CEO of Lateral Economics. I hope you enjoy it. Dr. Nicholas Gruen, welcome back onto the program.
Hi, Gene.
Nicholas, it's good to have you back on. I wanted to have you back on to speak with you about, first, a comment you made on the blog post I wrote relating to my podcast episode on David Graeber's Bullshit Jobs book. And yep. I thought in your comment, you articulated really well what I think I was trying to grasp at in my conversation, which the point is that one of the problems with Graeber's analysis of BS jobs is that it doesn't really have these strong economic or microeconomic foundations. It seems to be based on the fact that people like having others around them to stroke their egos. They like having flunkies around them, or there's this other concept he has of managerial feudalism, whereby because we've got these oligopolistic businesses, and they don't really have to profit maximize or minimize costs, and you can have these managers building up these big empires, these big bureaucratic empires to support them. It's almost going back to what Galbraith was arguing in the 60s, I think. But I just wanted to get your thoughts first on BS Jobs broadly, his idea of it, and then I'd like to explore an article you wrote on the competition delusion, where I think what you're telling me is you were trying to, that could be seen as a way of providing a more rigorous economic foundation for some of these so-called BS jobs we see.
Since you asked me to talk about this this comment I made, I have to warn the listener that I quite deliberately didn't read the whole of David Graeber's book. I noted his essay when it came out, and I wish I'd written an essay called Bullshit Jobs, because it's something on people's minds and it's a serious issue. So good on him for drawing attention to it. I was already very disappointed with the essay that he wrote, which was 5 years before the book that he wrote, because it seemed to me that the basic it was important to explain how the hell these things are proliferating. Now, maybe right now we should help just let the listener define what a bullshit job is. And David Graeber's definition, not terribly satisfactory, but anyway, it'll do, is he basically did a survey. It wasn't a very rigorous survey, and David Graeber's not a very rigorous kind of guy, but it was a survey of people who said, and they were asked a question like, it was a somewhat leading question, because it said, it didn't just say, you know, I find my job completely pointless, which is really the sort of thing that Graeber's getting at, but he also says, I find my job pointless, or it doesn't contribute to a better world, or something like that. And there's a huge number of different ways people can interpret that, and they probably interpreted about their own jobs differently on different days. But anyway, we all know that the sorts of jobs I can think of as bullshit jobs are things like PR, quite a lot of marketing, not all marketing. David Graeber's got it in for corporate lawyers, and that's okay with me. But if we get time, I'll make some comments about that. And he divides it up. You'll probably have the list in front of you. I don't. But also flunkies, people who are, you know, executive assistants, all the people who help advise a CEO would many of them would be seen to have bullshit jobs. So then he says, now these jobs are proliferating. He needs to have an explanation for why these jobs proliferate, and he's got a terrible explanation. And the explanation is that they flatter the ego of powerful people. Now, again, some listeners will be nodding their heads and saying, yeah, that's true. And it's certainly true that there are more jobs today that flatter the interests of powerful people than there were 50 years ago. And is it a good thing? No. Is it happening at some scale? Well, to some extent. Just look at a university where the executive, all the bureaucrats have metastasized and vice chancellor's salaries have gone through the roof. Some of the highest in the world happen to be in Australia, but they've gone through the roof everywhere. And vice chancellors have a court. So the office of the vice chancellor will be 20, 30, 40 people. I'm pretty sure none of that existed 30 or 40 years ago. So there's something to what he's talking about, but he has this embarrassing fact which he waves away, and that is, gee, there's been a lot of downsizing.
Yeah.
Why would people downsize? Well, if they're in the market, or they don't even have to be in the market, they might be in government and they're going through an austerity round, then people want to lower the costs of what they do. They're obsessed with that in business. And so it's, in a way, Graeber provides an interesting question, an interesting sort of paradox, which is at the time that lots of people are getting sacked, a lot of these bullshit jobs are burgeoning. So what's going on? It can't be he said, as a fundamentalist, it can't be that business wants to inflate its costs to the extent that the costs of all these jobs have been created. So I think the answer is really quite obvious, which is that if you think these jobs are useless, and I think some of them have certainly large quantities of uselessness, if you think that, then the answer is pretty obvious, I think, which is that they generate benefits for the employer, which is why the employer will hire the people. Think of an accountant who gets you off tax, okay? Now, we know why accountants get paid a lot of money, because they save their clients money through tax and a whole range of other things. That's true of PR people. You need PR people. I think it's terrible. Most of what PR people do is pretty awful. Again, well, let's park to one side. Maybe you can ask me a question. Well, what? Let's tell the story about what use these people do, because they do. Most of these professions have some uses, but most of their use is the use that you get when you stand up at the football, which is you can see a bit better, and then everybody else stands up and you're all in the same position.
Yeah.
And so, firms or political parties who have all kinds of people employed to help them spin a story, it benefits them, but it doesn't benefit them for long. So that's, it seems to me, what David Graeber should have talked about. Now, it's not always the case that if you have an economic understanding of what's going on, it's the most important thing. But here, I mean, what on earth is the point of talking about this phenomenon in a language which allows you to slag off but doesn't allow you any insight into what's driving it and therefore what you might be able to do about it?
Exactly. Can I ask you about corporate lawyers? Because you mentioned corporate lawyers before. When I spoke with Tim, who I was speaking with in that podcast episode, I asked him whether Harvey Specter, the lawyer in Suits, which Meghan Markle was in, whether he was a goon. So, I mean, one of the problems with our legal system, I think this is something you suggested in either the blog comment or in your article, is that it's so adversarial, and therefore you will have corporate lawyers and they're basically fighting against each other. And you have to wonder just how much social value there is in this, and all the millions of dollars that are wasted in this contest.
So, but that's probably, before I hop into the corporate lawyers, let's say some nice things about them first, which is, in fact, it's not really, I don't want to say anything nice about corporate lawyers. It's you just need them. There are lots of jokes about why scientists are using lawyers rather than rats in experiments and so on, which I won't go into. But the point is that corporate lawyers are to some extent, to a substantial extent, like checkout chicks, which is that you'd like them not to exist because you can't, because if the world would magically arrange itself so that everybody behaved themselves perfectly, you wouldn't need them. But the world, we'd never seen a world like that. So we expend some resources making sure that people write contracts with each other and so on. Now, that's the good part. And unfortunately, David Graeber said, I think, I haven't read the whole book by any means. I've only read tiny bits of the book in bookshops and before this podcast dipped into it a bit. But he has nothing to say about that. Now, that's really quite deplorable. We can't, any complex society like ours will spend a fair bit on corporate law. I think our society could get by spending maybe 25% of what it spends on corporate law. That would be an efficient amount to spend on corporate law. And it seems that some legal systems, particularly in Europe, spend about 25% of what we spend. So let's say that corporate law is 75% a bullshit job and there are goons, and 25% necessary. And that would, lobbyists. Nobody likes lobbyists. let's take it down to 10%. Lobbyists perform a useful role, which is that they inform politicians of issues that they're not aware of and inform them from the perspective of important people, important interests, and those important interests, they're not just powerful interests. If you're running a factory and producing 100,000 cars a year, it's important that governments understand things from their point of view. I'm going to give that 10% usefulness, and the rest is wasted money, but it's not wasted by the private individuals who invest in the lobbyists. That's the upside. And so now I want to sort of focus on the downside. And I think a really good way to do this, even since I wrote that article called The Competition Delusion, I've been basically trying to write a book around this particular idea. So let me hit you with it.
Okay.
Economists have a rather neat idea of where they divide the world into public goods and private goods. Let's just say they can do it perfectly, even though they can't, but that's a complication we won't have to worry about. Think of cars and think of roads. Cars are private goods. You buy them in the marketplace and companies compete to sell you cars. And here's the thing about cars. They're completely useless. Now, people will be wondering what the hell I'm talking about. Now, we'll change the frame and say, now, what do? Governments build roads. And roads are completely useless. Put them together and they're both very useful. So we need the market to produce private goods, and we need governments to produce public goods, and they complement each other very, very strongly. So here's my idea, that this is true of essentially every human institution and every human, indeed, every human interaction. Let me bring that home for you. Well, let's firstly talk about a game of sport. And we've just been watching Wimbledon. Give me a game. I can't even remember the name of the person in the final. Ash Barty. And who did she play in the final? Can you remember? She hadn't been in a final before. In the semi-final, it was Kerber, the German player Kerber. Now, those players competing, everyone agrees they're competing. But they're not just competing. They're also cooperating. What the hell am I talking about? Well, they're cooperating because they're playing according to the same rules. We take their cooperation so seriously that we've got a person there called an umpire, and then we've got another person called a referee. And if they don't cooperate in their competition is in fact built on their cooperation. If they don't cooperate, we make them cooperate. And tennis is useless as a competitive sport without it being a cooperative sport. So that's the idea. And so the rules are a public good, and the prizes, if you like, are a private good. So this is a sort of fundamental idea. So here's it's not a complete explanation of bullshit jobs, but it says a lot about bullshit jobs. And I think it's a very powerful lens through which to look at the economy, which economists have not, and other people haven't, taken this additional step. Wherever you see something that's not working well, some human institution, a business, something, you know, a government organization, a court, a conversation, and we might talk a bit about that in a minute. But wherever you see something that's not working well, ask yourself, is this a good ecology of public and private goods? Are the public goods and the private goods helping to reinforce each other and achieve a social purpose? Or is there some mismatch? And I can elaborate on some of those things using some of the examples that we talked about.
That would be good. If there's one example, I mean, you talked about roads and cars, which is that's a good one.
Let's look at a court case. And because we've got a nice contrast between two systems which have a different approach to the interface between public and private goods. In an English-speaking court, lots of people know that it's called, they use the system of procedure that they used is called the adversarial system. And the idea is that We just want the two sides competing however they can, and whatever they do, we put an umpire there or a mechanism deciding at the end of this huge, since we've already said bullshit, I'll call it a shit fight. Mm-hmm. We just have a huge fight between these two sides, and they'll do anything, and the two sides won't be required to try and solve the problem of who's right and who's wrong. They can play all kinds of procedural tricks on each other. They can delay, they can obfuscate, they can say, we don't concede this point, we'll put the prosecution or the plaintiff to the test, even though they ought to concede that point and allow the court to move on to the next point. And that is, that probably, I mentioned 25% efficient. American courts cost the American economy about, as a share of GDP, about four times what court cases and courts in Netherlands cost the economy in the Netherlands. It's worse than that, because it isn't just inefficient, it's also hugely unfair. Now, I'm going to read you a quote from André Geim. Who the hell's André Geim? Well, he invented graphene and won the Nobel Prize, an extraordinary, miraculous substance. Now, I've got to get him, hoping it's going to come up for me, and it hasn't just yet. And this is a quote from André Geim. We considered patenting. By the way, this is his English. We considered patenting. Then I had an interaction with a big multinational company. The guy told me, we are looking at graphene and it might have a future in the long term. If after 10 years we find it's really as good as it promises, we'll put 100 patent lawyers onto it and write 100 patents a day, and you will spend the rest of your life and the gross domestic product of your little island suing us. That's a direct quote, says André Geim. That gives you an idea. So it's not just inefficient, it's unfair, and it's predatory. It creates the opportunity for the strong to prey on the weak. And it's worse than that again, because consider what happens with expertise. So now I probably should explain the way it happens in the Netherlands and in Germany, in France, and all of these arrangements are somewhat different, and even the English-speaking ones are different. But this broad generalization applies. In the European system, it's also a pretty good system in Japan. In these systems, the idea is not, hey, let's have a competition between the two sides. The idea is, let's appoint somebody to find out the truth and the law and make a decision. And of course, that person has to be independent of the two parties. And that process is far more efficient and much fairer. So consider a situation where you're trying to deal with a technical question, which is whether a firm should have known that a particular substance caused cancer, and if so, when it should have known. Well, what will happen in an English-speaking court is that the two sides will have experts, and they'll choose their experts to spin, to be very frank about it. They may not lie, they probably won't lie, but they'll be chosen as tame experts to spin the truth their client's way, and there'll be quite strong relationships developed. Now, ask yourself, firstly, whether you think that's a good thing, whether you think that's going to are you happy with money changing hands on that basis? And then ask yourself, is this good for the decision in the court? No. Is it good for expertise? It's absolutely catastrophic for expertise. As a legal expert, a guy called John Langbein wrote, you couldn't think of a better way to make sure that expertise is ignored, because lay people are presented with two sides, each of which have been chosen to spin for their side.
Yeah.
If you send an economist out to talk about the law, almost invariably the only way they talk about it is in terms of, well, how could we deregulate this thing? And my argument is that that's not where the action is. The action is in the way in which the public and the private, the cooperative and the competitive aspects of this institution configured. And the way we've got it configured is, imagine if it was Wimbledon and the two players were expected to call all the line calls, and then they could, if they both disagreed sufficiently, we gave them each a right, a bit like Hawkeye, they could appeal to the umpire five times a game. It'd be inefficient. Everyone would hate it. Players would gain particular skills in how to exploit this situation, and none of it would be for the benefit of the game and for the spectators and the skill that's being shown and so on.
Yeah.
So that's a nice illustration of what I call a competition delusion, which is that thinking competition is good in itself, this idea that competition is good in itself, rather than the competition can do fantastic things if it's properly situated within a cooperative framework.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. So you're saying that, I mean, we've got to get the regulations right, of course, and one of the issues is, I mean, the legal systems are defined by various statutes and regulations in different jurisdictions, and it's arguable that what we've got in the English-speaking countries is inferior to what they've got in European countries.
Yeah, but it's also got to do with culture. A lot of it is to do with the way in which a culture evolves, and culture is a public good. Culture is this ground on which we cooperate, even as we compete. It gives us rules of behaviour. And the example of the courts starts to give you a bit of an idea of what of where these bullshit jobs come from, or it starts to give you a much richer picture of how you might how might we think about David Graeber's claim that corporate lawyers are doing bullshit work. I've already argued, I'll take it as proven, that some of the work that they do is good. So how could we lower the amount of emphasis we put on corporate law? And that is by using things like the inquisitorial, the European system, where the public goods, the things on which people are supposed to cooperate, are more strongly represented. And take an example like auditors get paid a lot of money. Now, the role of an auditor is to provide a public good. The auditor will provide a public good to investors in a business that the accounts say what they mean. It provides a public good for the whole society, for potential investors, for people who might want to deal with a company. So it's a public good. And how are auditors employed? Well, in the public sector, you just have to deal with an auditor. You get given an auditor. The Department of Treasury is audited by the Auditor General. It doesn't have any choice in that. The Auditor General will be able to hire a company if it wants to and send the auditors in. In the private sector, people hire, the firms hire their own auditors, exactly as in a court where each side hires their own expert.
And we've seen what problems that's brought about, haven't we, with particularly Enron with, was it Arthur Anderson many years ago?
Exactly. And so the public sector is full of this as well. So, I mean, it's not in auditing. It does a pretty good job on auditing. But if you think about the way in which we've got all these professions set up, if you want to get an environmental impact statement done, you go and commission it. I'm certainly familiar with the process of regulation review, where a department wants to get some regulation up, so it does. It's required to do a regulatory impact statement. Complete waste of time. The same kind of thing is happening right now. There's a $40 million expansion of money being given to evaluation in Indigenous programs. And it's the programs that, and it's the program sponsors who go off and get themselves evaluated. Hopeless.
Well, I guess with the regulation reviews, you've got to make sure you've got a body that's overseeing them or that will be signing off on them or ticking them off. So like, I know in Queensland here, theoretically, these reviews, they do get commissioned by departments, but they're supposed to be overseen by the Office of Best Practice Regulation.
Yep. How well do you think that works?
Yeah. I think you're onto something. I wouldn't say it's completely worthless, what the process.
I mean, again, I guess that's my point, that corporate lawyers aren't completely worthless, but the way we've set it up, we've made them a lot more of a pantomime than the real thing. And we can see some basic principles according to which we can make that a lot better. And there's a reason why we don't make it a lot better. And the reason is embodied in the joke that Lord Acton told round about the turn of the 20th century, where he said that rowing was the perfect preparation for public life because it enables you to go in one direction while you face in the other. And right. Certainly in public life, there is a huge amount of role playing, and that's it's kind of inevitable in the way that our media works, and we might get on to talk about some of that stuff. But we've actually quite deliberately set it up so that everybody can go through the motions and nobody gets embarrassed. And if nobody can get embarrassed, you don't have independent work, you don't have searching work. It's almost impossible to learn if you don't get sweaty palms about the fact that, well, what if my program doesn't work? What if this new thing I've done with the program doesn't generate any benefits? I mean, you don't need sweaty palms about that, but you do need to be curious and you do need to want to change it. And it's incredible how much we've covered that over in governments.
I might have to ask you about that another time. It's important. No, it's very important. I just want to get on to some other aspects of BS jobs, such as financial sector jobs. So now my thinking is that a lot of the expansion of the financial sector we saw before the financial crisis and a lot of the bad behaviour we saw, now that was aided and abetted by very loose monetary policy by the US Federal Reserve, and also just this idea that a lot of these financial services firms had that they were too big to fail or they could just get away with it, they'd get a bailout. Is that a problem? We haven't got those settings right, the regulatory settings around financial services, and that this has encouraged a lot of the bad behaviour and jobs, which you could argue whether just doing all this financial engineering and creating these exotic financial products that end up blowing up, you could argue they're BS jobs. But it's related to problems with regulation.
Yeah, well, I think it's an interesting question. There's lots going on. Let's try and unpack some of those things. Let's start when I hear this expression, you know, loose monetary policy created the problem. It seems to me that that's a very incomplete it's a very incomplete answer, and it's incomplete in this way. If we made car manufacturing unprofitable for a while, car productivity growth didn't sort of grow much and people became impatient to get better cars, the answer is, so what? Nobody starts building cars that blow up. Mm. So in smuggled into that explanation, loose monetary policy created the bust, is this idea that we've got to kind of keep returns going to finance because otherwise it'll make up these dodgy products, pretend to itself possibly and certainly to its customers that these are ways to get superior returns when they're actually not. In fact, a functioning finance system would be telling its customers, well, we could build dodgy products for you with securitization and slicing and dicing of obligations, But you shouldn't buy them because although for the reasons that Nassim Taleb talks about, which is that you'll make money most years, you'll make a bit of money most years, but all you're doing, it's a kind of an elaborate martingale strategy. And the martingale strategy is the idea that you toss a coin and you keep doubling the odds whenever you lose so that you always make a little bit of money. And then you reset back to one every time you win. And so you keep each episode, you win one coin, but you might have had to go double to you're now betting 16 or 32 coins to get your $1 back, your one coin back, and eventually you blow up. So that's what finance does when there isn't an easy way to make 4 or 5% on cash. Now that's so the problem there is that we have a finance sector which is predatory. It's a sector in which one of its main functions is to be more knowledgeable about the things that are being invested in than the customers. They're using our money to invest, you know, in BHP Billiton or whatever they're investing in. Their job is to know that well. But in fact, the way we've set it up is unlike most professions where at least 50 or 60 years ago there was a strong sense of fiduciary responsibility, there's very little of that in finance. So now I haven't thought enough about it to say that finance should be set up in that way. But that's something that needs to be said, that we've got a major dysfunction in finance, which is quite like the kinds of things that we've been talking about, which is that their role is to know more and to be honest about it, and that's not what their incentives face. Another one is too big to fail, and again, this is a somewhat unique problem to finance, which is that we've built our monetary system around private money creation. That's what banks do. And that seems to me that creates all kinds of issues. And again, we could, there are people very left-wing and people very right-wing who both agree that we should take money creation off the banks and the government should effectively create money. That Milton Friedman argued that his whole life, and various much more left-wing people have argued that. That is one way to massively reduce the one-size-fits-all problem. Now, what that would involve, anyway, that's another complicated story. Another thing that I think needs to be said about finance is that because finance has moved so far from relationship finance to collateralized finance, that is, we take a mortgage on whatever property you can provide us, and then we lend you money, that creates a ratchet in which asset prices rise and then the whole system becomes financialized. So if everybody's lending a lot of money for you to buy your house, you can buy a more expensive house, everybody else can buy a more expensive house, and before you know it, everyone, the ownership of a house, it involves three times as many payments to the bank as it used to. And that's everyone standing up in a stadium. So they're all doing less well. Now the answer to that is some kind of financial regulation, and that imposes its own costs. So you have to try and think about those things on their own, on their merits. But the situation we've got at the moment with very, very rampant financialization, I think, has been very damaging in all kinds of ways. And well, we know that from the financial crisis, but also from the extent to which ordinary people and firms now pay money to financiers in a way that doesn't get them more things. It just play. It means that everybody has stood up at the football so they can get a better view.
Yeah, yeah. Look, it might be good to see if we could wrap up on this issue of money creation, because one thing I did want to chat with you eventually was your central bank digital currency paper. So you mentioned, well, you alluded to the fact that, well, banks create money when they extend credit, and when people pay back their debts, or when they pay back loans to the bank, then that sort of money is taken out. It's extinguished, isn't it? So the net additions to the money supply depend on the difference between the creation of credit and the paying back of debts. And I guess what Friedman was arguing is that, well, he wanted to have this constant money growth, didn't he? And he thought that the Federal Reserve could engineer the system in such a way that you had the money supply growing at this K percent.
Well, no, but I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about monetarism. I'm talking about a 100% fractional reserve banking.
Oh, okay. So
you're familiar with
Yes.
So his mentor, Henry Simons, came up with a plan before, was really towards the tail end of the Great Depression and before World War II, for a system in which governments generated money in the way that they print notes and mint coins that we have in our wallets, that sort of money, not physical, I mean, so the money supply is about 5%, 3 or 5% that, and 95% or more banks making loans. And what the Chicago plan that Milton Friedman promoted involved was for governments to make up the whole of the money supply, and therefore you would then, money would be created by government, and banks would have to, if banks were financing something, they'd have to go and get the money to finance it. It's a complicated story. But the point of one of the things that is important about this is that it changes. It was Irving Fisher is one of the people who was promoting this, and he was arguing that it hugely reduced the cyclicality of the economy, the extent to which the economy goes through booms and busts. And something that Milton Friedman was alert to, and which I think is a big deal, is that it makes the government a lot of money, just as the government makes what's called seigniorage revenue from printing notes and coins. In this system, it makes money with all of the money in circulation. Now, in fact, it's not seigniorage; it's interest payments for reasons I won't go into. But that is a huge opportunity. So this is something around which this is now a much more live issue, because everyone's talking about digital currency, and the central banks of the world are asking themselves, could the central bank issue digital currency? And my answer is they should, and that there are huge gains from doing this. But of course, to do so, threatens the existing banking system and their model for making money, and does threaten, while the existing system is dominant, it does threaten the stability of that system. So there are lots of interesting things to be thought about.
Yeah. So you wrote an article in the Financial Times, the world's leading, or arguably the world's leading financial newspaper that comes out of London, you arguing that, well, this is something that central banks, they're looking at, and it's very likely they could implement it, and there could be big efficiency gains from having central banks issue currencies. And this could be something that is, well, it would compete with crypto. I mean, I'm very negative about crypto. I think crypto is a bit of a scam. So, yep. But this sounds like something that it potentially has some merit. So would you just be able to spend a few minutes just taking us through what you were arguing in that article, please, Nicholas?
Let me try and do this I'll see if I can explain this in a bit of a roundabout way. In the 30s, you've probably heard of war bonds. During wars, governments are out there saying to their citizens, buy war bonds. War bonds are just bonds from the government, and they And it's a sort of a patriotic thing. You know, you can lower your own consumption, invest in war bonds, and in the end, you'll help the government win the war, help your country win the war, and you get paid interest later on. Now, when I think it was Roosevelt tried to make bonds more, wanted to sell more bonds, they ended up issuing baby bonds. And the thing is that bonds had been built for the financial markets, not for households. And so baby bonds are quite cleverly designed so that they're denominated in small amounts. And not only are they denominated in small amounts, but you don't have to account for them every year. You hold them, and they've sort of got five coupons on them. And over 5 years, you earn the full amount, and then you get it given to you. So you go out and you buy a bond, and the bond might be for 20 American dollars, but you buy it for $17.50. And then you just hold it at home, and then in 5 years' time, you take it to the post office and you get given $20. So what's happening there is that the government's doing two things. It's borrowing money, but it's asking itself, how can what I do be useful to the citizenry? And of course, in the one thing, it's sort of doing savings bank work for it. And you can also keep these bonds in the bank if you like. So it's trying to think of this as, if you like, a two-sided market, as it's trying to think, how can I be useful while getting certain financial transactions that are attractive to me done? And I think of central bank digital currency in a similar kind of way. And I think of the currency in our pockets as something similar, which is that effectively the notes in our pocket are in some kind of sense an interest-free loan from us to the government, and the government's given it to us in a way that's super useful for us. So central bank digital currency is really the digitization of that. And so the way it would happen is that there's a research paper by Michael Kumhoff and a guy called David Baradir, I think. I met him one day and he had an Australian accent, and I said, "You're Australian?" He said, "No, I'm English, but he was born in Australia, he sounds Australian." And they published this article in 2016, and the experiment they do is they issue 30% of GDP, which is a lot, as central bank digital currency. And anyone can go out and get them, so they can buy this digital currency. How would that be financed? Well, what happens is that the government retires 30% of GDP of bonds, of borrowing that it's already got, and it's making this thing available to the market, and it has a usefulness. So people will want to buy it, and they'll give up some interest to buy it because it's more useful to them. So all of a sudden, the government, by making this thing, putting this thing in a useful form, in a form that's useful for people who hold it, gets itself a cheaper source of debt, and it's a substantial source of debt. And that then becomes a currency within the economy, or the currency is already set, pounds in England or dollars in Australia or America, but it becomes a new instrument of currency, a new token of currency, and that becomes, and that creates all kinds of additional efficiencies. For instance, once you've got CBDC, central bank digital currency, it becomes much easier for local people to compete with Visa and MasterCard and PayPal and all these networks that are taking very large profits because they're exclusive and very widespread networks. So there are all those kinds of benefits from doing this.
Okay. So, Nicholas, how would it work? Would it mean that instead of me having an account at Westpac, I would have an account with the Reserve Bank of Australia?
No, I think you would have the account at Westpac. Westpac would go out and buy the CBDC for you, and then Westpac would be competing with Google and Woolworths and specialist companies who would say, download our app, you can put your CBDC, your central bank digital currency in the wallet on your phone, and you can spend it anywhere you like. So the central bank would just be issuing this central, would be sitting it on the top of this system, and in a way that correlates with banknotes and so on, every central bank digital currency would have a unit of currency, would have its own number, and the system would know where it was and so on and so forth. Does that make sense to you?
Not really. It's different from what I thought. I thought what you were arguing was that...
Yeah, well, I've previously argued, before the CBDC issue came along, I've argued that every Australian should be able to have an account with the Reserve Bank of Australia in the same way that Westpac can. And so that's a somewhat separate question, but the effect of this is a different technology for delivering something very similar. So that's one way to think about it. But even if we were to have direct accounts with the Reserve Bank, I think that it's highly likely that we wouldn't log on to the central bank, that a system would come up where we could do it with our own bank, we could do it maybe through Google or Woolworths or a number of other service providers would provide us with a more user-friendly way to do this. But the actual reality of the situation would be that we all had access to the central bank's balance sheet.
Okay, so what advantage would it have over normal dollars that we had in our bank accounts?
It provides a way to transfer currency. Whenever I'm trying to think about this, I just default to notes. So what's the advantage of a note? The advantage of a note is that you and I can sit in a lounge room. We can't do it now because we're in different cities. You and I can sit in a lounge room. We each have certificates which are on the central bank balance sheet, and we just swap them. So we could do it through a bank if we wanted to, but we can do it on our own. So this is a network with access to the central bank's balance sheet, which is much more flexible than having to subcontract it out to a specially regulated bank.
Okay, so there'd be savings on transaction costs.
Correct.
And is it also possible that, so instead of having a note where we're not earning any interest on that,
yeah, you could have interest on it. You can have interest earned on it.
Right,
as well.
Okay.
Yeah. And so the model that Michael Kumhoff and David Baradir have is an interest being paid on central bank digital currency, but a lower level of interest being paid than on bonds, because people want to hold these things because they're useful.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, well, that's great. Well, I'll put a link to your competition delusion article and your central bank digital currency article in the show notes. Is there anything you'd like to say in conclusion, Nicholas?
Just doubling back to this story of when I was talking about experts in a court, and that experts have become not experts but spinners in effect, and I wanted to draw attention to the way in which our world, in many ways we're getting back to the bullshit job story, the way in which our world has become much more bullshit friendly, bullshit intensive. And if you look at not just PR but politics, we only ever hear spin. You know, we heard that New South Wales was the gold standard in dealing with COVID until it wasn't. We were told that by someone who didn't particularly believe it. I mean, he probably thought it in some casual sense, but it was highly irresponsible to say it because he had no idea whether that was true. And that is now the norm of our public life. And that's why I think we can take this idea of economics, that public and private goods, that things that we compete on and things that we cooperate on, that these things aren't separable. They richly complement one another. And when things are going wrong, there is a mismatch between what we're getting people to cooperate on and what we're getting them to compete on. So that's going right back to an earlier part of the discussion. But that seems to me to be the problem of our time.
I think that's a good point. Okay, Nicholas Gruen, CEO of Lateral Economics, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks a lot, Gene.
Okay, that's the end of this episode of Economics Explored. I hope you enjoyed it. If so, please tell your family and friends and leave a comment or give us a rating on your podcast app. If you have any comments, questions, suggestions, you can feel free to send them to contact@economicsexplored.com and we'll aim to address them in a future episode. Thanks for listening. Until next week, goodbye.